Hello, welcome back to yet another episode of Mr. Jeffrion's World History Podcast. Today, for episode 26, we will be discussing traditions and change in Eastern Asia. Some key themes to keep in mind and probably study up on would be the quest for political stability, economic and social changes, Confucian traditions, and new cultural influences, along with the unification of Japan. If you listen to today's podcast and have any questions regarding what we've discussed, feel free to let my team of TA helpers, and myself as well, know by submitting your question to the Google Voice number, which is 321-804-APWH, or feel free to email mrjeffrion@gmail.com. While areas such as sub-Saharan Africa and parts of the Americas may have suffered because of increased contact with the Europeans, the East Asian states benefited from long-distance trade. It would be centuries before China and Japan fell under European domination and control. As had been the case for centuries on end, China remained the dominant power. The chaos of the Mongol control gave way to a restoration of Chinese traditions and a return to glory under the Ming and Qing dynasties. Japan was unified under the Tokugawa shogunate and began its evolution into a powerful state. The quest for political stability started in the Ming dynasty, as Emperor Hongwu succeeded in restoring order back to Chinese traditions after the Mongol rule of China under the Yuan dynasty. One thing that the Ming Empire tends to be known for is the construction of the Great Wall of China. The Great Wall, built on the remains of earlier walls that dated back to the Qin, was also representative of the Ming desire to ensure order and control contact with the outside world. Following in Han Wu's footsteps, later emperors of the Ming dynasty tried to continue the idea of keeping order throughout China. Emperor Yong Li achieved this by building the Forbidden City, used for the capital of the Ming dynasty and even the Qing dynasty later on. Yong Li also financed Zheng He's adventures as he set out on multiple explorations throughout the Indian Ocean basin to showcase China's wealth to the rest of the world. Unfortunately, later emperors, most notably Wan Li, retreated into a world of opulence and ignored the demands of running the country, which would lead to the collapse of the Ming Empire, as it will later be overrun by the Manchus, who established the Qing dynasty. The Manchus were highly focused on keeping society pure, forbidding intermarriage and forcing Chinese men to wear certain clothing, showing their submission to the Manchu people. Although harsh, the Qing dynasty flourished greatly, as China would come to have control over most of Eastern Asia. This was mostly due to Kangxi and Qianlong, the two main emperors of the Qing era. Both the Qing and Ming dynasties relied on bureaucracy, as civil service examinations were still intact to ensure there were enough qualified people to run the state. Throughout the Ming and Qing dynasties, economic and social changes were made that affected traditional patterns. One example of this would be filial piety and how it extended now to the patrilineal clans. Clan leaders that then saw fit to supply financial aid to poorer family to help with their education and welfare. The relationship between the sexes, which had always been dominated by males, became even more patriarchal during the Ming and Qing years. Foot binding is probably the best example of the deteriorating status of women. Foot binding was a way for women to show off their elegance and place in society as it gave them higher status. Another major change to society were more efficient techniques in farming. Chinese farmers started a form of intensive farming on whatever suitable land they could find that they could cultivate. New crops were introduced to these farmers, helping to increase food supply, which led to a massive population rise. Of course, economic and social problems were soon to follow this rise as the population increased from 100 million to 225 million after 1500. During these years, the Chinese enjoyed very favorable trade income. While the Ming and Qing may have enjoyed internal stability, their failure to back innovations helped ensure that China fell further behind the Europeans technologically. Both the Ming and Qing emperors were very active sponsors of the Confucian tradition, especially the work of the Neo-Confucian scholar Xu Shi. His call for self-discipline, filial piety, and obedience to establish rulers was exactly what the emperors needed after the chaos of the Yuan dynasty. Meanwhile, Christianity, led by the Jesuit Matteo Ricci, returned to China in the 16th century. Ricci attempted to win converts and impress the central court of Wanli with examples of European technology. His work, The True Meaning of the Lord of Heaven, attempted to convince the Chinese that the philosophies of Jesus and Confucius. Ricci failed in his attempt to unite Confucian and Christian philosophies, and his arguments were decided to be invalid by the Chinese. Kangxi eventually put an end to Christian preaching in China, but only in response to papal declaration against Confucianism. Despite limited success in winning converts, the work of Matteo Ricci and others dramatically increased the European knowledge of China. Around 1660, Japan went through a major change. The country became unified. The previous four centuries are often referred to as Sengoku, the country at war, as the country was torn apart by incessant warfare among the nobles, the daimyo. Under Tokugawa Ieyasu, Japan became unified and centralized. He did this by limiting the amount of power the daimyo were able to have, and also by a policy of his called alternate residence. In the 1630s, the Tokugawa shoguns carried this desire for stability one step further by cutting ties with the Europeans. By establishing the policy known as Sokoku, the shoguns expelled European merchants and missionaries and prevented the Japanese from visiting foreign lands. Although some Chinese and Dutch trading companies were allowed to communicate with the Japanese, the rest of the world was cut off. Only the port of Nagasaki would be open for trade. The separation from the rest of the world brought about peace and stability, leading to a decline in warfare and a rise in the population. However, the Japanese population increase would pale in comparison to that of the Chinese. Through a combination of infanticide and abortion, calling the thinning of rice shoots, the land-poor Japanese maintained slow population growth. This can be seen by the population of Japan growing a mere 10 million people from 1600 to 1850. Before the isolation from the world, Japan practiced a form of Neo-Confucianism. This all changed when the separation from the world occurred. The Japanese began to turn their back on what they viewed as foreign influence. This was a call for a return to folk traditions and Shintoism, as well as a view that the Japanese were superior to other societies. Although, try as they did, the Japanese found it impossible to keep foreign ideas out. Soon European concepts such as astronomy and medical science started to seep their way into Japan, which to them was called Dutch learning, because it came, you guessed it, from the Dutch. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to remember the key themes mentioned earlier. Remember, if you have any questions on today's podcast, contact me via the Google Voice number or MrJeffreyOn@gmail.com. Special thanks to T.A. Tanner for putting this episode together for us. Tune in next time for episode 27, Islamic Empires. Until next time, this has been Mr. Jeffreyon's World History Podcast.